having me. Thanks for coming out so late in the year, everyone. So I'm going to talk about this paper, which is the same name as the title. And like Lathan said, it was with Kurt, who's at Case with me, where I'm a postdoc. So I'll give you some rough outline. I'm going to start with some motivational slides. Then I'll get into the main part of the talk, which will be about various aspects of Kaluza-Klein theories. And I'll break that into two parts. And then I'm going to conclude. So let's start with the motivation. So if we have a theory with a bunch of massive spin 1 particles, and we calculate a 4-point tree amplitude using just these particles, it will always grow at high energies, like some power of the center of mass energy E. So for example, in the standard model, if I write down amplitudes using just the W and Z bosons, I find that it grows like the square of the center of mass energy, this 4-point amplitude, for longitudinally polarized external states. And so what this means is that this amplitude is becoming bigger than 1 at some energy, and therefore it's violating perturbative unitarity. In this case, the scale at which that happens is around 800 GeV. And this tells us that something new has to happen. Either some strong coupling phenomena or some new particles have to enter. And this is the basis for the no-go theorem for the LHC. It's why the LHC had to see something new. So as we all know, the LHC did in fact see something new, namely an additional spin 0 degree of freedom, the Higgs boson. And in terms of these amplitudes, the role of this Higgs boson is to allow me to write down this additional diagram, which has the effect of precisely canceling off the bad high energy behavior of these preceding two diagrams. So when I add everything together, this 4-point amplitude is now bounded at high energies, so this theory can make sense to arbitrarily high energies. There are also Higgsless solutions to this problem that people explored, especially before the LHC turned on, such as strongly coupled Technicolor models. And you can also solve this problem using extra dimensions. And this is going to be more in line with what I'm going to talk about. So this was all massive spin 1 particles. My focus is going to be on massive spin 2 particles. So you can try and do something similar and see what happens. So the simplest case to consider is we have a single massive spin 2 particle, and we try and write down a 4-point amplitude, which has the best possible high energy behavior. And it turns out, if you choose all the couplings right, the best you can do is to write down an amplitude which grows like the 6th power of the center of mass energy. So unsurprisingly, this is much worse than in the spin 1 case. But this is also much better than the generic case for a massive spin 2 particle. And in fact, this optimal high energy behavior is realized by these theories of ghost-free massive gravity, which were written down in the 2010s by Duram, Gabbardazzi, and Tolle. There's also another example of a theory which saturates this bound, and those are the only two examples. So we might now try and ask whether or not we can do better than this. So whether we can add additional particles, like in the Higgs mechanism, to cancel off this bad high energy behavior and have a theory with an improved high energy limit. The simplest thing to try would be to add a bunch of scalars and vectors, like what we do with spin 1 particles. However, it turns out if you try this, you can't do any better than this e to the 6 behavior. So adding any number of scalars and vectors can't help improve upon this. So you can phrase this as the fact that there's no Higgs mechanism for gravity, using only scalars and vectors. And this was a result in a paper early in the year, together with Kurt and Rachel Rosen. Yes?
So how much of e to the 6 comes from the fact that gravity is not renormalized?
Right, so it's...
model, there is a unitarity problem before we... Higgs, but at least that's
so this makes it even worse. Adding a mass makes it even worse. For regular gravity, it would be E squared, which is this telling you that it's not renormalizable. The cutoff is M Planck. This is telling you if you add a mass, it gets even worse. It gets you to e to the 6. So correspondingly, the cutoff is the cube root of M squared M Planck, which is much, much lower than M Planck for small mass. So this is telling you that these are badly non-renormalizable theories. Um, Okay. So we can't do any better just by adding scalars and vectors. However, it turns out we can do better by adding an infinite tower of spin two particles. Namely, this is what happens in Kaluza-Klein theories, and this is what I'm going to talk about in great detail in this talk. So that's one positive way around this, no-go result. Another solution is given by string theory. So in string theory, you can have massive spin two excitations. And here the amplitudes are exponentially soft at high energies. And this is achieved by the fact that you have an unbounded number of high spin particles. But I'm going to focus on this KK example. So more concretely, in this talk, I'm going to try and answer the following questions. First question is, how do the massive spin 2 tree amplitudes get partially unitarized in KK reductions of pure general relativity? And I should point out that recently this was also considered for the special case of a one-dimensional compactification, where you have one internal dimension, by these people, Sikkar, Chivukula, and collaborators. So the second question is whether or not we can engineer parametrically large gaps in the Kaluza-Klein spectrum. So if we could geometrically engineer the internal space so that you could have arbitrarily large gaps between the KK modes, then you could effectively integrate out all but a finite number of these KK modes and be left with some effective field theory which inherits the good high energy behavior of GR. So that would be interesting if it were possible. So I'll answer that question. And lastly, as a sort of bonus question, I'm going to ask whether or not this tells us anything interesting about geometry. Okay. So before diving into the details, let me give you a cartoon overview of the calculation. Just so everyone knows where we're going. So the first step is we're going to start with higher dimensional general relativity on a product background spacetime, which is a product of little d-dimensional Minkowski space with some closed internal manifold, which we'll denote by calligraphic N. So we have this high dimensional space, and then we're going to integrate out the compact internal dimensions. So we're going to go to this lower dimensional flat space. And this is going to give us some equivalent lower dimensional theory, which involves infinite towers of particles whose masses and interactions are determined by the geometry and the topology of the internal space. So for example, the squared masses of the particles in the lower dimensional theory, these are going to be related to eigenvalues of certain Laplacian operators on the internal space. And the cubic couplings, which I'll denote by G, these are going to be given by integrals of products of three eigenfunctions of these Laplacian operators. And I'll give concrete examples of this later. Okay, so once we have the lower dimensional theory, we can figure out the interactions and calculate a four-point scattering amplitude. So I'm going to look at the four-point amplitude of external massive spin two states, which I'll denote by these coiled black lines. And I have to include also the exchange of all the different other KK modes. So once I calculate this amplitude, I can expand it at high energies. And generically, this amplitude starts with a term which grows like the 10th power of the center of mass energy, and then it has a subleading e to the 8 term, and subleading terms going all the way down. So each of these powers of the center of mass energy has some coefficient, which is a function of the masses and the cubic couplings, as well as the kinematics of the amplitude. Now, in higher dimensional general relativity, the four-point graviton amplitude in any dimension grows like the square of the center of mass energy. Since this theory is just an equivalent lower dimensional rewriting of high dimensional GR, and because at high energies, the infrared effects of the compactification shouldn't matter, our physics intuition tells us that this lower dimensional amplitude should also grow at most like the square of the center of mass energy. So this tells us that secretly, the coefficients of these first four terms should be equal to zero. So the perturbative unitarity of high-dimensional GR is giving us equations of this form, which are constraints on the masses and the cubic couplings in the Kaluza-Klein theory. So these constraints, these are so-called sum rules, because they involve the masses and couplings. And by studying these sum rules, it turns out we can deduce interesting things about the masses and cubic couplings, the general geometries.
The idea is to try to improve the unitarization by including only gravity, no extra fields at all.
So here I'm going to start with high-dimensional pure GR. But some of the conclusions we'll go through for more general things like string theory.
So these coefficients are zero.
Yeah.
The scale of the so where do the in the energy scale where do the KK modes enter at what energies?
So their masses are much lower than this energy because I'm always taking a high energy expansion.
Okay.
So I'm expanding around E equals.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
So this is, if you believe this argument about high-dimensional GR and enforcing this, this is guaranteed to happen. Because of what I talked about at the beginning, this is going to require some non-trivial.
How do they compare to the mass of the graviton here?
So this would be roughly the inverse of the radius of the extra-dimensional space. That would be the lightest KK mode. Okay, and so lastly, it turns out these sum rules, indeed, you can prove them directly using properties of eigenfunctions and eigenvalues. So this proves that this cancellation that we expected does in fact happen and follows just from general results about geometry. Okay. All right, so this is the end of the overview. If there are any more questions about what we're going to do, this is a good time to ask. Otherwise, let me. Yeah.
So, what if I look at standard model fields coupled to gravity? So, where would those in your list, alpha 10, alpha 8, alpha 6? So, where those guys would, or they will always be in alpha 2?
Right. No, I think, so in the KK case, there are going to be scalars and vectors around, which come from the high dimensional components of the graviton. And these come in starting from alpha 6. So I would guess it would be the same for additional external scalars. Yeah. And then, similarly, in that case, these would have to separately cancel for those terms as well. Yeah.
So I guess, let me rephrase. Maybe I can rephrase my question. What if I don't do high dimensional GR? Well, OK. I mean, if I do high-dimensional GR with a standard model like so does that mean that there will be a modification of the sum rules, but the sum rule will still require including pretty much arbitrary type of matter that all this alpha 10, alpha 8. I don't want to do massive gravity. I'm asking if I just normal Einstein gravity plus matter, and I do Kaluza-Klein reduction. So you are telling me that there will be generically alpha to the 6 because of the coupling to the matter.
Yeah, so there'll be this term plus an extra term from the matter, which will separately have to vanish because
so
I can freely vary a couple.
That kind of runs against the intuition, right? So I would still expect that if I do Kaluza-Klein reduction and I get a normal Einstein-Hilbert term in four dimensions, it should be like E squared. So is that something that can be proven as well?
So maybe I'm not understanding your question, but this cancellation of the pure gravity terms, this should happen independently of any extra matter you have.
Okay, that was my question.
Okay.
So an extra matter would not spoil that?
No, it won't spoil it, yeah.
Okay, that was my question.
Right, okay. Yeah, you see these things, we can prove them just using basic facts about geometry, so they're just true statements. Yeah.
So I was confused.
Right.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's get into the main part of the talk. So I'm going to start by deriving the interactions in the low-dimensional theory, and then I'll use them to calculate some amplitude and sum rules. So let's start with the interactions. So like I said before, we start with capital D-dimensional GR, described by the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian. And we're going to consider the background spacetime, which is a little D-dimensional Minkowski across some compact without boundary internal space, telegraphic N. So I'm going to choose this internal space to be connected and orientable in addition to closed. And its volume is going to be denoted by capital V. So the line element for this product background spacetime takes the following form. So the high dimensional background metric breaks up into a low dimensional piece, which is just Minkowski. And then there's the internal piece, which is some closed manifold. So the indices on the internal space are these middle of the alphabet lowercase Latin letters. And I use Greek letters for the Minkowski space. So this background solution has to solve the vacuum Einstein equations for this to be consistent, because I'm starting with pure GR in this case. So this tells me that this internal manifold has to also be Ricci flat. Namely, its Ricci curvature has to vanish. So we need a closed Ricci flat manifold. It turns out that such manifolds are relatively rare amongst all Riemannian manifolds. The known examples are basically just flat toray, Calabi-Yau manifolds, thanks to Yau's proof of Calabi's conjecture. And then there are the exceptional holonomy cases, the compact G2 and spin 7 manifolds, of which the first compact examples were constructed by Dominic Joyce. You can also have products of these and quotients. But roughly, this is all there is, as far as we know. So one important fact about all of these examples is that they all either have special holonomy or make covers with special holonomy. So what this tells us, which is important for this talk, is that all of these manifolds admit parallel spinners. So it's going to be a useful fact that we'll come back to later. Okay, so we have our background spacetime. Now we're going to expand around it perturbatively. So we write the full metric as the background plus a perturbation, which is the higher dimensional graviton, denoted by capital H. And then we can plug this into the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian and expand it out to get the kinetic term plus the cubic interactions, the quartic interactions, and so on. And one further thing is that to leading order, the gauge transformations of GR, or the diffs, act on the graviton just as the standard lower dimensional diffs, like this. Okay, so this should all be relatively familiar. Before I move on, I need to now make an aside just to introduce some notation and some different functions. So I need to introduce three sets of real orthonormal eigenfunctions for the internal manifold. So the first set are going to be the non-constant eigenfunctions of the scalar Laplacian, which I'll denote by psi sub a. So a is going to be a discrete index, which labels all of the eigenfunctions of the scalar Laplacian. So that just means that these functions are, if I act on them with minus the Gordon operator, gives me back the same function times some positive constant lambda sub a, which is the eigenfunction, the eigenvalue. Additionally, I also need a set of eigenvectors, which are transverse of the vector Hodge Laplacian on the internal manifold. So I'm going to index these by a discrete label, which I'll call I, and n is the vector index of the internal manifold. So these y's are transverse eigenmodes of the vector Hodge Laplacian, which for a Ricci flat manifold just means that minus the Klein-Gordon operator acting on them gives me back some non-negative constant lambda sub I times the function, which is the lambda sub I is the eigenvalue. Okay, and lastly, I need a set of transverse traceless symmetric tensors, which are eigentensors of the natural generalization of the Laplacian for symmetric rank 2 tensors, namely the Lichnerowicz operator. So these symmetric transverse traceless tensors, HMN, I'm going to index by this discrete label calligraphic I. And these are defined to be the eigentensors of this Lichnerowicz Laplacian, which for a Ricci flat manifold is just minus the Klein-Gordon operator plus a correction proportional to the Riemann curvature of the internal space. And so acting with this Lichnerowicz operator on these eigentensors, gives me back the eigentensors times some real eigenvalue lambda sub calligraphic I. So using sort of well-known results, about elliptic self-adjoint operators and compact manifolds, we know that these eigenvalues, they're all discrete and unbounded from above, and moreover that the corresponding eigenfunctions, they all form bases of the corresponding eigenfunctions, of the corresponding function spaces.
Tensor case, is it also bounded from below? You don't write it bounded from below.
Yes, it's not. So, importantly, which I'll come back to. Yeah.
Is the choice of real eigenfunctions crucial?
It's without loss of generality, and it makes the formulas easier to interpret later on. So if I have complex ones, I can always split them up into real parts. Yeah. But it would just mean that the integrals of products of these are manifestly real, which means I can impose unitarity much easier. Yeah.
It's a technical requirement rather than
right, yeah. And I can always do that without loss of generality. Yeah. Okay. So what we're going to do now is break the high-dimensional graviton into different pieces, which we expand over a basis of eigenfunctions of these various Laplacian operators that we just introduced. And this is the generalization of what you do when you have a circle as an internal manifold. You Fourier decompose everything so that you can integrate over the internal circular dimension. So this is a generalization of that, which is going to let us integrate out the extra dimensions in this more general case. So this high-dimensional graviton has scalar, vector, and tensor components from the point of view of the internal space. So these H, mu, nu components, these look like scalars. The off-diagonal terms look like vectors, and the HMN components look like tensors from the point of view of the internal manifold. So beginning with the scalar components, I can expand these in a basis of eigenfunctions of the scalar Laplacian using the fact that these eigenfunctions are complete. So I get the following expansion. H mu nu equals some coefficient, which looks like a tensor from the point of view of lower dimensions. And this multiplies the scalar eigenfunctions. And this term is just the zero mode, which I've explicitly separated out. Similarly, I can expand the off-diagonal vector components using a combination of a Hodge decomposition and an eigenfunction decomposition. So first I use the Hodge decomposition to write the vector as a transverse piece plus longitudinal piece. And then I can decompose the transverse piece as over the eigenfunctions of the spin 1 Hodge Laplacian. The coefficients now look like vectors from the lower dimensional perspective. And then the longitudinal components, which I'm not going to write out explicitly, I can similarly decompose using the scalar eigenfunction expansion. Okay. Now lastly, I have the tensor components from the point of view of internal space, these HMNs. And I can always decompose a tensor into a transverse traceless piece plus a trace plus a longitudinal piece. So I'm just going to write down the transverse traceless piece, and then I'm going to expand it over the eigentensors of the Lignerowicz operator. So the coefficients in this case, in this expansion, are scalar functions from the point of view of lower dimensional space-time. And then I can do similar things for the trace and longitudinal modes, but I won't write those out explicitly. Okay. So now is a convenient time to fix a gauge. So it turns out there's an analog of unitary gauge, which allows me to eliminate these longitudinal modes. And so you can think of this as like a Higgs mechanism, whereby these coefficients, which are going to be spin 2 particles in the lower dimensional space, these are eating the massive vector components in this longitudinal part to become massive. And these vectors here, similarly, they're eating a longitudinal component to become massive. Okay. So once I have this decomposition, I can plug it in to the quadratic part of the high-dimensional Lagrangian. I can use the orthonormality properties of the eigenfunctions to integrate out the internal dimensions. And after demixing things, I can figure out what the spectrum is in the lower dimensional theory. And I find the following thing. So let's start with the spin 2 piece. there's a tower of spin 2 modes, beginning with a zero mode, which corresponds to the lower dimensional graviton, which I'll draw and read here. And then there's this infinite tower going all the way up, whose squared masses are determined by the eigenvalues of the scalar Laplace. Similarly, there's a spin 1 tower, which can have a finite number of zero modes, one for each Killing vector on the internal manifold. And then there's the tower going up, whose squared masses are determined by these non-zero eigenvalues of the spin 1 Hodge Laplace. Finally, there are two spin 0 towers. So first, there's this tower corresponding to the trace of the high dimensional graviton. And the masses of this tower are the same as the spin 2 tower, namely they're determined by the eigenvalues of the scalar Laplacian. And so there's always similarly a zero mode, which corresponds to the volume modulus. Okay, and lastly, there's this remaining scalar tower, which is set by the Lichnerowicz eigenfunctions in the internal space. And in this case, like Latham asked before, it's not necessarily guaranteed that the Lichnerowicz operator is positive definite. So there can be, a priori, a finite number of tachyonic modes. Similarly, there can be a finite number of zero modes. There's one for each shape moduli of the internal space. And then there's the infinite tower going up. And I'm going to denote these fields as I've indicated below with these Feynman lines. Okay, so we might worry about the presence of tachyons, because this would mean we have an unstable compactification. However, it turns out there's a nice theorem which comes to our rescue in the Ricci flat case. So there's this theorem due to originally a mathematician, Mackenzie Wong, and then it was later discovered by some physicists, Gary Gibbons, Sean Hartnell, and Chris Pope. And it says the following thing. If I have a positively curved Einstein manifold, which admits a Killing spinner eta, and namely a spinner which satisfies an equation of this form with some constant kappa, then it turns out there's a lower bound on the Lichnerowicz eigenvalues, which has this form. So it's some multiple of the curvature where the coefficient is a function of the dimension. What we're most interested in is the Ricci flat case. So if I just set R to zero, it turns out this inequality still holds, namely for a closed Ricci flat manifold whose cover admits a parallel spinner. That's the case of kappa equals zero. It turns out the Lichnerowicz eigenvalues are always non-negative. So that means for all known closed Ricci flat manifolds, there won't be tachyons. Because all known closed Ricci flat manifolds have covers with special holonomy and therefore admit parallel spinners. So it's an open problem whether or not this is true for all closed Ricci flat manifolds, namely whether or not there exists a simply connected closed Ricci flat manifold with generic holonomy. But all of the known cases will give stable compactifications. Okay. So that was the spectrum, just a linearized part of the theory. To calculate some amplitudes, we also need nonlinear terms. So we're going to calculate a four-point amplitude with all external massive spin 2 particles. So we need the cubic interactions with at least two massive spin 2 modes. So let's start with the cubic interactions involving three massive spin 2 tensors and two massive spin 2 tensors in the graviton. These have the following form, which I've indicated just schematically. The important thing to note is that in the case of the cubic interaction of three massive modes, the cubic coupling is determined by this thing I call G with the KK indices. And this G is defined as this integral of the product of three eigenfunctions of the scalar Laplace. So this is a special, this is a particular case of that formula I wrote down in the overview. So the cubic couplings are determined by integrals of products of eigenfunctions. Okay. One interesting thing is if I figure out the on-shell cubic vertex in this case, it always takes the following Einstein-Hilbert-like form. So namely, it's the square of a Yang-Mills amplitude. And so this is true even though these are now massive spin 2 particles. And this you can think about, there's a nice interpretation of this tensor structure in terms of these asymptotic superluminality constraints. But that's just an aside. Okay. We similarly need the cubic interactions with two massive spin 2 particles in a vector. So again, the important thing is that this cubic coupling is determined by an integral of the following form. So it's a product of two scalar eigenfunctions and a vector eigenfunction. And I denote the cubic coupling with this schematic Feynman picture. One nice trick that you can do in this case is to take the gauge variation of the corresponding on-shell vertex. And in the case where this is a Killing vector, the gauge variation should vanish, since the spin 1 particle should be massless. And indeed, you can check that the gauge variation has the following form, which you can write as an integrand, as an integral, where the integrand vanishes when Killing's equation is satisfied. So that's a good check. Okay, and lastly, we need the interactions with the scalars. So there were two towers of scalars. There was the tower of scalars labeled by the scalar eigenfunctions and the tower labeled by the Lichnerowitz eigenfunctions. In the case of the former, the cubic couplings are again given by these integrals of products of three eigenfunctions of the scalar Laplacian. And in the case of the Lichnerowitz tower, the cubic couplings are given by the following thing, which is an integral of a product of two eigenfunctions of the scalar Laplacian and a Lichnerowitz eigentensor, as you would guess. Okay. All right, and we also need the quartic contact term. So in the case of four external massive spin 2 particles, the quartic coupling, which appears in this case, unsurprisingly, is given by an integral of a product of four eigenfunctions of the scalar Laplacian. So that gives us this term. Okay, so now we have all of the ingredients we need. We can go ahead and calculate an amplitude. So as I've mentioned before, we're going to calculate this amplitude by four massive spin 2 particles labeled by their KK numbers, A1 through to A4. And schematically, the amplitude looks like this. So I have to sum over the infinite number of exchanged massive spin 2 particles, the graviton exchange, the tower of vectors that are exchanged, the two towers of scalars that are exchanged, and then there's the contact term as well. So this gives me some complicated amplitude. I can expand it at high energies, like I said at the beginning, which gives me an expansion starting at the 10th power of the center of mass energy and going all the way down. So as an example, this leading piece, described by alpha 10, it starts with a term of the following form. So it is quadratic in the cubic couplings, as you would expect just from looking at this diagram. And then it depends on the dimension and the masses and so on of the other things. Okay, so the next step is going to be to impose that these first four coefficients will vanish for general kinematics. And this will give us some sum rules, which, because of that argument I said at the beginning, we expect to always be true in these theories. So let's start with the simplest case, which is the e to the 10 sum rule. So I set alpha 10 to 0, and it gives me the following three relations. It tells me that I should be able to write the quartic coupling, G, with four subscripts, in terms of sums of products of cubic couplings, where I write the products in three different ways. So here I have 1, 2, 3, 4, here I have 1, 3, 2, 4, and here I have 1, 4, 2, 3. So if you stare at this for long enough, you figure out how to prove these sum rules directly. And so the trick is to do the following thing. We use the fact that a product of two scalar eigenfunctions is itself a scalar, so I can expand it in a basis of scalar eigenfunctions. And this gives me an expression like this. So here, I'm using this Wick contraction notation, to indicate that I take the two fields, which are connected, and I expand them in a basis of the appropriate eigenfunctions. So in this case, I get the following thing, where the coefficients you can show are precisely these cubic couplings that I introduced before. So this is just, I'm inserting a completeness relation between these two. So now what I can do is I use the fact that the quarter coupling was defined to be this integral of a product of four eigenfunctions. Since this product is associative, I can choose to expand these products of two eigenfunctions using this eigenfunction expansion in three different ways. Namely, I can expand on 1, 2, and 3, 4, on 1, 3, and 2, 4, or on 1, 4, and 2, 3. So this is maybe reminds you a little bit of the OP associativity, which you use to derive crossing equations in conformal VF theories. And this is roughly analogous to that. So by expanding these integrands in different ways, I recover precisely these sum rules that I got from the amplitude calculation. OK, so that shows why these sum rules are true. And this will be useful for helping us derive the more complicated examples that will come to now. So let's go to the next subleading term, which is the e to the 8 part of the amplitude. So its coefficient is alpha 8. And when I set this to 0, in the special case where I have identical particles, so from now on, I'm going to restrict, just for simplicity, to scattering four identical massive spin 2 particles with KK index A1. Then I get this sum rule, which I've written here. So there's a term here, which you can see comes from summing over the exchange of the massive spin 2 states. And then there's this constant term, which comes from the graviton. And the sum rule tells me that this particular combination has to add up to 0 once I sum over all of the exchange KK states. Now you can see that because these cubic couplings are real, because I've chosen to work in a basis of real eigenfunctions, this square is manifestly positive in the unitary theory. So this thing can only add up to 0 if there is some A for which this cubic coupling is non-zero and the coefficient of it is negative. So this tells me that there has to be some A star such that the cubic coupling is non-zero and lambda A star is strictly greater than 4/3 lambda A1. So in terms of particles, this tells me I have to exchange a KK state whose mass is strictly greater than 2 over root 3 times the mass of the external state. I can reapply this argument, now taking this massive exchange particle as the external state. And this unitarity condition tells me that I need an even heavier particle in order to unitarize its amplitudes. And then to unitarize the amplitudes of that particle, I need an even heavier particle, and so on. So unitarity is telling me that I need an infinite tower of particles in this case, which we already knew, but it's a nice consistency check. Moreover, this also tells you that if you take a finite truncation of the tower, which includes some massive modes, then you're going to spoil this sum rule and the earlier one. And so you're going to be left with a theory which has e to the 10 amplitudes. So if you take a KK theory and you just abruptly truncate the tower, you don't get nice effective field theories of massive spin 2 particles.
So what is the cutoff of the theory?
The high dimensional Planck mass.
Before, yeah. Compared to the before the case. So before you had diagrams that diverge like e to the epsilon energy to the 6th power. Now you have e squared, so the cutoff is where now compared to the, let's say the mass is m of the graviton, now the cutoff is where?
So the cutoff's always the high dimensional Planck mass.
So it's lambda
which is,
times the cutoff of the
Depends on the dimension, so in,
the strong coupling scale in the extra dimensions.
Yeah, it's because this is the same theory. This is just higher dimensional GR, but I've rewritten it in a manifestly lower dimensional way. So the cutoffs have to match.
Okay.
The way they match is slightly non-trivial. So if you just looked at these single particle amplitudes, you would see that the leading term is e squared.
Yeah.
And so that would suggest that the cutoff is actually the lower dimensional Planck mass?
Yeah, exactly. That's
right.
Why I was asking. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So the resolution is that there's a parametrically large number of states below the cutoff. So if you consider scattering modes, which are superpositions of this parametrically large number, then that pulls the cutoff down. Yeah. So it all works out.
Yeah.
Oh. All right, and one final comment is that this is the same summary you would get if you started with higher dimensional Yang Mills and you repeated this calculation. Namely, you imposed that the lower dimensional amplitudes were bounded at high energies. So that means that these sum rules have to be true for any closed manifold, because I can define a Yang-Mills theory on any manifold. So I haven't made use of the Ricci flatness condition yet. Okay. So I'm going to rewrite this sum rule in a slightly obvious way, but this will be useful for the more complicated ones. So I'm going to rewrite the sum rule as some polynomial, which I'll call P sub e to the 8, which is the function of the ratio of the eigenvalues times some term which is manifestly positive, plus a term which is also manifestly positive. So in this case, this polynomial is just a linear function, 4 minus 3x, which I can plot in this purple line. And then the point of this is that I can directly read off from this graph what this sum rule is telling me about where new states have to come in. So the sum rule tells me that I have to exchange a particle whose mass is sufficiently heavy that this ratio falls on a point where this line is negative. So I need an exchange state in this case whose squared mass is greater than 4/3 the squared mass of the external state. So this is just an equivalent way of saying what I said before, but it will allow me to quickly write down the other sum rules. So this was e to the 8. Now let's go to e to the 6, the next subleading term. So in this case, I get the following extra sum rule, which I'm going to immediately write down in this form. So I have some term, which is a polynomial of the ratio of eigenfunctions, plus a manifestly positive term. And in this case, the polynomial is some quadratic function, which depends on the dimension. So schematically, it looks like this. So what this is now telling me is that I have to exchange a state whose mass is such that this ratio falls to the right of the intersection of this red line with the horizontal axis. So this is a slightly stronger condition than when I got from e to the 8, because it's telling me particles have to come in that are even heavier than I thought from before. But at this stage, the particles which come in, they could be arbitrarily heavy. They could be anywhere to the right of these points of intersections, so they could be all the way up here. So the final sum rule, this is, comes from the e to the 4 part of the amplitude. This gives us something more non-trivial. So in this case, I have some polynomial here, p sub e to the 4, which it turns out is a cubic polynomial. And schematically, it looks like this, this blue line. And now the interesting thing is that there's only a finite window at which this polynomial is negative. And so this is telling me that I have to exchange a KK state whose mass is such that this ratio falls within this finite window. So I need to exchange a state whose mass squared is less than 4 times the mass of the external state squared. So this is now some non-trivial piece of information. And in particular, it implies the following fact about eigenvalues of the scalar Laplacian on closed Ricci flat manifolds with special holonomy, namely that the ratio of consecutive eigenvalues can be at most 4. So lambda sub k here is the kth non-zero eigenvalue of the scalar Laplacian. So by studying unitarization of scattering amplitudes, we find this bound on eigenvalues, which is just some pure geometrical fact, which has to be true for all of these closed Ricci flat manifolds. And as far as we know, this wasn't known before. So this is interesting partly because general closed manifolds don't admit bounds of this form. So there are results due to this mathematician, Colin de Verdier, which tells you for a general closed manifold, any finite number of eigenvalues are essentially arbitrary. So in particular, they can't be constrained bounds like this. So in terms of particles, what does this tell us? So this tells us that we can't have arbitrarily large gaps between the KK excitations of the graviton. So the mass of the K plus 1th excitation has to be less than or equal to 2 times the mass of the Kth excitation. So this answers that second question that we had at the beginning in the negative. So we can't have arbitrarily large gaps. Since this is just a pure fact about geometry, it also applies to more complicated cases where we start with more complicated higher dimensional theories. So in particular, it applies to smooth Calabi-Yau compactifications of string theory and to G2 compactifications of M theory.
So is it really applied? Because there are extra states. There is
PDU,
there are lots of other stuff there.
But the masses of the KK excitations of the graviton, they're still determined by these eigenvalues.
Back to my sort of original question. So now when I have this extra matter in 10 or 11 dimensions, then there would be, you know, and all that matter coupled to gravity, so they could take part in unitarization.
Right. So the sum rules could be different, but this is still true. Yeah.
No, this is true because you impose a condition for a particular. I'm not sure. Okay.
Is this true for if it's Ricci flat, but if it was instead an Einstein manifold with a non-zero cosmological constant, it would not be true?
I'll tell you what happens in that case soon. Yeah. But so far, I've only proven it for Ricci flat. Yeah.
So I thought you have an external. You know. So you. You produce those bounds, assuming that you have four external massive gravitons.
Yeah, that's right.
And you assume that whatever is exchanged inside are just gravitons.
Yes.
And so now I'm saying, but I'm asking. So now there is a possibility, again, I have the same external legs.
Yeah, but there's more stuff inside. Yeah.
Because there is extra matter in these complicated cases.
Yeah.
Then you get a different thing.
Yeah, you get a different sum rule.
Are you saying that I would still get the same bound on eigenvalues of massive gravitons?
So I'm not necessarily saying it would come from that sum rule, but since I've shown that this is just a pure fact about geometry, which is true regardless of whatever matter is around, as long as the masses of the KK excitations of the graviton are described by these eigenvalues, then since this is just a true fact about these eigenvalues, it corresponds to this statement about the masses.
I guess I'm missing still that thing. You showed that because some of the alpha 6 or alpha 8 vanishes.
Yeah.
Which was coming from the unitary. And I'm saying that alpha 8 or alpha 6 is going to be different. So this condition could be different.
Right. So, maybe you're saying the way I proved this was assuming just pure GR in high dimensions.
Yeah.
But I'm going to show you now that you can prove this just using facts about geometry. So that it doesn't involve anything about physics.
Okay, so that's not done yet.
Yeah.
So
this, although I started from GR to get this, I can now just shortcut and prove this directly just by playing around with eigenfunctions. So it's an indirect way to get to this, but this should be true. It is true. Okay. So as an example, it turns out this bound is saturated by certain long tori. So for example, in two dimensions, I can write any tori by drawing a parallelogram and identifying the opposite sides. And the moduli in this case is a single complex number, tau. And the conformally inequivalent tori live in this fundamental domain of the complex plane. And it turns out that all of the tori corresponding to the shaded blue region, these saturate this bound for their first two distinct eigenvalues. And similarly, in any dimension, you can show that this bound is saturated by a torus, which is the quotient of Euclidean space with some lattice gamma, which is generated by integer combinations of the unit vectors, where I take one of the vectors multiplied by some constant p, which is greater than or equal to 2. So this corresponds to a torus, where I make one of the directions larger than the others. So these long tori, these saturate this bound, which shows that it's an optimal bound. Okay. We would like to try and test this on more complicated examples. Unfortunately, on Calabi-Yau manifolds, which would be the next simplest case, not much is known analytically about the eigenvalues and eigenfunctions. So you have to do stuff numerically. There's an algorithm due to Donaldson, which lets you approximate the Ricci-Flatt-Kahler metric on Calabi-Yau manifolds. And this was developed by these people, Volker Brown, Mars Brilisi, Mike Douglas, and Bert Overit. And so what they found, for example, for the Fermat-Quintic threefold, which is the hypersurface in CP4 defined by this homogeneous 3-5 polynomial, where these z's are the homogeneous coordinates, projective space, they found that the lowest eigenvalues of the scalar Laplacian had the following. And so you can easily check that these are well within this factor of 4. This is another weak check of this. And this is all this. They also considered many more examples, and these other examples also satisfy the bound quite easily. Okay. Let me tell you now how to derive the sum rules. This is coming back to what you asked. So it turns out you can derive them using these analogs of the crossing equations. So the trick is to write down an integrand, which involves a product of 4 eigenfunctions of the scalar Laplacian, dressed with some number of derivatives. And then I evaluate these integrands in 2 different ways using the eigenfunction decompositions. So I can, and this gives me the following crossing equations, which for e to the 8, e to the 6, and e to the 4 correspond precisely to those sum rules that I wrote down earlier. So here I'm not talking about particles in extra dimensions. I'm just playing around with integrands of eigenfunctions. And these reproduce precisely these sum rules. The nice thing about this is that you can repeat this calculation for general Einstein manifolds. So I'm not restricted to Ricci-Flatt anymore. And if you do this, it turns out that the corrections you get for non-zero curvature, these are exactly positive in the case when the curvature is positive. So that tells me that everything I said from before also goes through for Einstein manifolds with non-negative curvature and non-negative Lignerowicz eigenvalues. So in particular, this includes Einstein-Sasaki manifolds with dimension less than or equal to 9 by this bound on the Lignerowicz eigenvalues from Hopital that I mentioned at the beginning. And I guess the nice thing about this is that these appear in ADS-CFT examples where the Einstein-Sasaki manifolds are the compact internal space cross with ADS. And in these cases, you can identify the eigenvalues with scaling dimensions of operators in the dual CFT. So these bounds translate into bounds on these operators. One other thing I can do is, so here I started with higher dimensional GR, and I worked my way down by integrating out the extra dimensions. I can also do a pure agnostic EFT calculation, where I just write down the most general flat spacetime theory involving scalars, vectors, and tensors, and I calculate a scattering amplitude and impose that it grows no faster than the square of the center of mass energy. And if I do this, I get some sum rules on the general couplings that can appear between these particles. And it turns out these sum rules still imply this fact about the ratios of consecutive masses of the spin 2 particles, namely that they're bounded above by 2. So in particular, this means that this fact is also true for more general compactifications where I have things like fluxes and brains and so on. So it's not just a fluke of the Ricci-Flatt case, so this is true. Okay. Let me tell you about some more interesting stuff that you can do with these sum rules. So we just stared at the sum rules to derive these facts about bounds on eigenvalues. This suggests that maybe if you look at them a little bit more carefully, you can extract some further useful information. And it turns out that this is true. So one thing we can do is we can impose that there's a gap in the Lick-Narrowick spectrum. And then we can reformulate the sum rules as a semi-definite programming problem. So we can solve this using standard exact or numerical computer algorithms. And we can get plots which look like the following. So here, I'm plotting the first and second distinct eigenvalues of the scalar Laplacian, where I've normalized them by setting the volume equal to 1. So that's what the hat means. And I've shown shaded regions for different assumed gaps on the Lick-Narrowick spectrum. So as I increase the gap to the first non-zero Lick-Narrowick mode, I get stronger and stronger bounds on the allowed parameter space of eigenvalues. I can also generate bounds on qubit couplings by doing this. So it turns out if I look at the qubit coupling corresponding to the self-interaction of the lightest KK mode, then I can derive an upper bound on this in different dimensions, which has the following form. So this black line is the maximum size of the qubit self-interaction of the lightest KK mode. So it can't be arbitrarily heavy. Actually, it becomes infinite in 14 dimensions. Only for 13 and fewer dimensions is this finite upper bound. You can do something you can do even more by making additional assumptions about the gap between the first and the second eigenmode of the scalar Laplacian. So what I'm showing here is an upper bound on the qubit coupling of the lightest KK mode. As I increase the gap between the eigenvalue of the lightest KK mode and the eigenvalue of the next lightest eigenvalue, which appears in its eigenfunction expansion. So here, when this value is 1, I reproduce the bounds that I showed you in the previous slide. But as I crank up this gap to the next eigenvalue, at some point it starts decreasing. And by the time it gets to 4, it has to become 0, because I know for the manifolds which saturate this eigenvalue bound, namely tori, this qubit coupling is 0.
I have a silly question. So you put a hat there, so I guess it's some dimensionless qubit coupling, right?
Yeah, so yeah, the hat means...
Should I worry is that the number of qubit coupling is larger than 1 and whatever the natural units are? I mean, you are using, you know, unit, some perturbative unitarity argument, right? 3-level unitarity.
Right. No.
So where is the breakdown of perturbation theory in this language?
Right. So I was always assuming some weak coupling expansion and energy over the cutoff scale.
So that graph, where is the weak coupling?
Right. I think as long as it's, for any particular example, it's going to be some finite number, which compared to this ratio, which I send to 0, is negligible. So in the limit that I'm doing everything, it doesn't matter how big this is. If you were trying to impose exact unitarity, not just perturbative unitarity and some weak coupling expansion, then you could worry more about the size of these qubit couplings. Okay, and as one last thing, you can also get upper bounds on the qubit couplings of the lightest KK mode to the shape moduli. So here, it grows with the eigenvalue of the lightest KK state, but their ratio is some fixed number, which I can bound from above. And interestingly, the upper bound, which is this yellow line, is exactly saturated by a torus in n dimensions for n up to 6. And then for n bigger than 6, it starts growing relative to the torus. And then at some point, it becomes infinite again. Upper bound. Okay. All right, so let me conclude. So we've seen how geometry achieves the unitarization of the massive spin two amplitudes by the fact that certain sum rules are satisfied automatically. One consequence of these sum rules was that the masses of adjacent KK states couldn't be arbitrarily different from one another. There was this factor of two between them at most. So let me then finish with some open questions, since I started with some questions. So one interesting question is whether or not there are further constraints that you can get on the spectrum or the cubic couplings from looking at mix or higher point amplitudes. Another question, which is much harder, is whether or not geometry is the only way to unitarize massive spin two amplitudes without including higher spin particles. And then an even harder question again is how unique is the string theory solution to this unitarization problem once you allow higher spin particles? Okay, so I'm going to finish there. Thanks.
Okay, any questions? So if you apply this to brain rule scenarios where the Planck scale is not high, can you get interesting phenomenological constraints that are relevant for collider searches?
Do you mean with the cubic coupling specifically, or
the masses?
The masses.
Cubic couplings. Are there models in the literature that, I don't know, have not done this carefully and contradict bounds, or
right?
I don't know. Is there any interesting constraint that you get?
Yeah. So this factor of four thing is, or this factor of two for the masses, is true also for these Randall-Sundrum and Brainwald type models. So yeah, indeed, this should tell you that once you see one massive spin two, the next one has to be right around the corner. I'm not sure if people have made assumptions that violate that. I think people usually have in the back of their mind that you shouldn't have arbitrary large gaps between them. I guess one thing is sometimes people calculate the effective potential using only the lightest KK mode, but this tells you maybe that isn't a good approximation because the next lightest one is not too far away. So to calculate the potential, you should really include several of the low-lying eigenmodes. Yeah.
And maybe back up just one. So the results you presented only have to do with the spin two tower.
These ones, or yeah, these couplings are specifically for the spin two KK modes.
Sorry, are you asking about phenomenological constraints, like experimental constraints? Well, you cannot have the graviton. I cannot see here how you can have the graviton lighter than a inverse than a milli V, because the KK modes are at that scale. So gravity is not, it's not the Newton's law is modified. Okay.
Basically saying you have two choices. You either can take a, if you want the theory to have a high cutoff, which is corresponds to the cutoff in the extra dimensions, the Planck scale in the extra dimensions, then you have to have quite a dense tower of these states. The other option is to just have a theory that has like a single graviton, but is only valid in, up to a very, very low cutoff. So maybe much bigger.
Yeah, that's what
the
question was. Yeah. I mean, the effective cutoff of 40 massive gravity is like 1,000 kilometers, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Which is pretty low.
Yeah.
I mean, principally, you could still say maybe it's valid on scales, cosmological scales, but then it's just not mass gravity is not the valid effective field theory in the solar system. So that's a problem.
Don't know what to do with 1,000 kilometer cutoff.
It's just saying it can't be the right effective theory.
I agree with that. That's why I'm saying that here, though, I cannot see how you can make the graviton much lighter than a milli V, because that's the constraint from Newton's law.
Yeah, that wasn't really my question. I was actually talking about high energies. So
yeah.
This is for GR, right? In dimensions. So if I have a theory where the Planck scale is that around the TeV.
Yeah, there's some constraint here on the KK modes. Yeah, but those are not that severe. I mean, the more severe thing is the
I understand, but there's an implication, like, because I mean, like you said, if you posit that there is one KK mode here, you can't make the next one arbitrarily heavier.
No,
so that would imply that you should account for not just a single mode, but you know.
People have done this in the course of large extra-dimensional matters, right?
Yeah, my question is more: are there new constraints?
Are the constraints that you would get here any different than you would get in large theories of large extra-dimensions or RS?
No, so at least this factor of two between the subsequent ones, this is true in all of those cases as well. It's I guess a more complicated calculation because the analog of the Eigen function expansion is more complicated because you have to try and integrate products of Bessel functions and stuff, but yeah. So very sorry.
I realize I'm confused about the. So if you took the mass of the graviton to be very low, isn't the statement that it could be still the effective theory on, let's say, big cosmological scales, but it just could no longer be the right effective theory in the solar system, like GR would have to be the effective theory in the solar system? Like, doesn't the cutoff just not let you?
Yeah, you can't rule it out. You just don't know what the EFT is.
You can't rule it out. You can't use it.
I don't know. I mean, it's strong coupling on the Earth's surface, so you don't know if apples fall on the Earth. So I don't know what theory is that. At least here, I mean, here is a concrete realization that can push the cutoff in theories where we have checked the full range of validity, right? So here the theory is well under control, but it cannot be as light the graviton as in the other case. I mean, this is much more viable.
All right. Well, so are there any further questions? But maybe before people run away, I just want to state one further bound, which is that James will be here until 4 tomorrow.
12, yeah.
Until 12 tomorrow. Okay, until noon tomorrow, if you'd like to talk to him any further. And then are you around for dinner tonight? So maybe we'll take you to dinner at 6 tonight if anyone wants to join. And let's thank him again.